Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or you can go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. That'll take you straight to the good stuff. On Fast Forward Radio and on The Speculist, we talk about the future, and we talk about the future in a somewhat different way than you're likely to hear anywhere else. We give you the straight scoop, and the straight scoop is that the sky is not falling, and if you're really willing to look at the evidence, we live in a world that might just be getting better all the time. And moreover, we stand on the brink of what could be an incredibly bright future, if we play our cards right, a future that most of us haven't even imagined, much less dared to hope for, and a future that we're all very much going to want to live to see. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, how are you doing, Phil?
I'm super fantastic. How are you?
Man, having a great Father's Day. How about you? I hope you are.
I am having an excellent, excellent Father's Day, and we want to extend a warm Father's Day greeting to, I'm going to try to match my Mother's Day thing here.
Okay.
To all fathers listening, grandfathers, stepfathers, fathers-in-law, fatherly types, father figures, fans of the Father Dowling Mysteries, anyone who has a father or has ever had a father, we hope you're having a wonderful Father's Day. I hope I didn't leave anyone out there.
I think that's everybody. Yeah.
You know who I left out was Michael Darling. Michael, are you on with us this evening?
I am. Happy Father's Day to everybody and everywhere.
And to you as
happy
well.
Happy Father's Day across the board. How's your Father's Day treating you?
It's good. Tiger Woods pulled a miracle to extend his U.S. Open by a day, so that was something. And
wow.
He got a birdie in that last hole?
He birdied the last hole, which
that's what he needed.
Two strokes into the last hole, you're like, yeah, it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
It was
amazing. I stopped watching because I figured it was all over.
Oh,
nope.
That's really pulled it out. Huh?
That's great.
He made what for him were, you know, you look like it, you go, oh, those were pretty normal shots for him, but he made two great under pressure shots to tie the thing up, and they'll be golfing all week apparently.
Wow. How about that? Well, I've got a rather lengthy Father's Day story that I feel I must share, and I hope you'll all bear with me on this, but
go for it, man.
You know, there's a lot of talk in the web circles that Stephen, that you and I follow and that we link to, you know, in our kind of blog universe, you read a lot of talk about man bashing and male bashing and all that kind of stuff, and how, like, I don't know if you saw the thing on Dr. Helen's blog about these commercials that reinforce these negative male stereotypes. And
I've watched every one of those commercials because some of them were hilarious.
I thought they were funny. Okay, I cannot get my consciousness raised to where male bashing bothers me. You know, to me, all humor is based on male bashing. The best humor in the world is the Three Stooges, and that's three guys beating each other up. You know, occasionally a woman shows up and smacks them around too, and it just, for me, it works. But
I think part of it is that men, you know, are willing as comedians to put themselves on the line and to make fun of themselves to a greater extent than women are. Now, there's some exceptions. I mean, you know, some great comedians.
Oh, but definitely there are women who will put it on the line too. But yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, but it seems like it's men more than women, and so maybe, and I don't see how that becomes male bashing. That's just, you know, guys being funny.
It's just being funny. Yeah, yeah. I mean, a joke has to be at somebody's expense, and guys are about all we got left. So we get to be the butt of the joke, and I'm afraid, really, if guys start getting really serious about this, oh no, we're being bashed. You know, we've got to. Then there'll be no humor left, right? If anything, I think we need to set a good example and say, yep, we're the butt of the joke, and if we can be cool about it, maybe other people can be cool about being sometimes the butt of the joke. But
pretty much the humor here on this radio program is self-inflicted. It really
it's always at our expense.
Almost always
at our expense. Yeah.
Yeah.
Frequently unintentionally, but. So which leads me to my story. All that's to say that the stereotypical like dumb dad who's always like stepping into it. Okay.
Yeah.
I am that guy, all right, to the point where my wife's nickname for me is actually Clark Griswold. Okay, she calls me that on occasion, and I live up to it pretty well. So I'm going to tell you that earlier this week, as a Father's Day gift, she bought me this beautiful new bike rack to go on top of my Subaru Impreza, okay? And it's one of these, it's a Yakima, it's a full stand-up. It's not just the fork, but you stand the entire bike up on top of the car, and then you're ready to go. You go to the trail, and you can pull the bike right off and just start riding. It's beautiful black rack. It goes with my black Subaru Impreza. It's a Yakima, but it got it from the dealer, so it says Subaru on the side. I mean, just cool-looking, awesome, totally righteous bike rack that she gets me. And I want to tell you guys, because I know you're worried right away, you know, how did Phil screw up his bike rack, that I maintained an absolutely perfect record of driving with my bike rack the entire first time. Okay,
and then, just the first time.
And then yesterday, I was returning from a bike ride, and I attempted to drive. I attempted to drive into my garage with the bike still.
Oh no! Oh man! And, so you run? Did you? Okay, let's count the ways you screwed up. You messed up the bike, I'm sure.
Well, actually, the bike came out okay. I messed up the garage framing there pretty good. You know, it's one of those things, it's like, what's that sound? Oh no, I got the, you know, that whole moment of, I've got the bike up there, what have I done? And you stop, and things are still, and then it's like, should I back up? And, oh, is it making it worse? What's going to go on? And the greatest thing, my next door neighbor living up to the, you know, proving that I live in a sitcom about the dumb dad, okay? Because the smart aleck neighbor comes over, and what does he say to me? Hey, Phil, you know, you got a bike on top of your car.
Here's your sign.
Extremely helpful. So finally, I back up. He grabs the bike. We pull it off, verify that the bike is okay, but the rail of my beautiful new Yakima Subaru-branded bike rack is a complete pretzel. Okay, I mean, it's just ruined. And I'm just so, like, mortified with embarrassment and, you know, just depressed. It's like, I got this righteous new thing, you know, and I've had it less than a week, and I've ruined it, right? I've completely destroyed the thing. So she gets home, and I tell her, look what I did, sorry. And she says, well, maybe you can buy just that part. Maybe you can buy a new rack. You know, accidents happen. She was completely cool about the whole thing. And, you know, I tried to sort of move on.
You were beating yourself up more than anyone else could, that's for sure.
Well, I just felt, you know.
Yeah, you felt awful.
It's like you want your Father's Day gift to last at least until Father's Day, I guess, is kind of the, you know, if you can somehow keep it in working order at least that long, you'd feel pretty good about it. So this morning, my wife and daughter take me out for a special treat. We go to back-to-back movies. We go see Iron Man and then The Incredible Hulk. So, I mean, they're just completely indulging me for Father's Day. And, you know.
You had seen Iron Man before, right?
No, this was...
okay, cool, okay.
Yeah, so I got to see, it's like, and they really go together well, these two movies, and it was just a great geek-out kind of a day. But somewhere in there watching Iron Man, there's this, like a second level of message I'm receiving, okay, and I don't want to spoil too much, but seriously, if, as Jeff Bridges would say, okay, if Tony Stark can build an arc drive in a cave, all right, I got to be able to fix my bike rack. And I start thinking, you know, about ideas about how can I do this? You know, I just need something straight. You know, I wish I had Tony's tools. If I had his setup, you know, if I had that place in Malibu, I know I'd be able to do this. So we get home from the movie, and I take the very twisted, very bent, very banged up rail of the bike rack, and I attach it to my ladder with some C-clamps, and then I get a hammer and just start pounding on it. And it took about an hour and a half. But I straightened that sucker out and put it back on, and my bike rack is restored. I've still got some garage repair work to do, but you know, the awesome ending of the story is that by geeking out, going to see Iron Man, I was able to, you know, build my confidence, see myself as kind of a superhero, and solve my own problem.
You are the Iron Man, no doubt.
That is my Father's Day tale.
I'll just throw one footnote in there. The comical way to fix your garage would be with like the classic cartoon cutout in the shape of your bike. so that you could drive in with the bike still in the rack right through the little cutout.
That's a great idea. Well, wouldn't you know, as I'm
if you were Tony Stark, your garage would actually open up to allow it to come in.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, as I'm putting the bike back up there, the neighbors arrive home. They've been out hiking, and they come out to talk about, did you buy a new rack? I'm like, no, I fixed the one. And he was duly impressed because he had seen it in its pretzel form. And I told him, I said, yeah, I've got it all set up here. I'm going to try driving in again because I don't know what went wrong that last time. So.
Well, that's great.
Allowing myself to be the butt of the joke. But
yeah.
But anyway, all that to say, I had a super fantastic Father's Day. So, Stephen, you said you saw the Hulk as well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Let me ask first before we get into that. Did you stay through the credits on Iron Man?
You had told me to, so I definitely did. Now, I've got a question for you. Was I supposed to do the same thing for the Hulk? Because I did not.
I did not sit through the Hulk credits either because I had no word that I should.
Okay, well, here's a quasi-spoiler. I think that the very final scene of the Hulk was actually originally going to be after the credits.
Okay.
Doesn't it feel kind of like that last scene after the credits at the end of Iron Man, sort of?
Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. It does. And those credits were so long in Iron Man, it almost, I almost got up, even though I knew I needed to stay. But it was worth staying. So if you haven't seen Iron Man, please don't leave. Sit through the credits. You'll find that it's worth it. So.
Yeah, although I will say that I sat there going, no, Steven says we got to wait. And when the scene comes and the thing that happens, I'm just like, oh, that is so cool. And I turned to my wife, and she goes, yeah, that was really worth it.
I've somehow managed from three states away to get in trouble with your wife.
Another movie in the same
daughter.
Anyway, we didn't have anywhere to go anyhow. So.
Okay. Yeah. That's funny. Anyway.
So,
Hulk. On Hulk, man, okay, here's my thoughts. If we want to spend some time on the geekiness of this, it seems to me that now Marvel has three big ways that you can become a superhero.
Okay.
Okay. Way number one is freak accident. You can be bit by a spider or fall into acid or something like that, you know.
Right.
And become a superhero.
Cosmic radiation in the pogo plane or, one of those.
Yeah, or something weird like that happens to you that's just freaky and you become a superhero. Number two, you can be born that way as a mutant, and then become a superhero. When you turn 13, 14, whenever it is, and get your powers. But the third way, and it seems that both Iron Man and Hulk falls into this, and there's a third one. There's a third major hero in the canon that I think that they're leading up to, is to be a super soldier.
Right.
And Iron Man is an effort to do it with hardware, and Hulk was an effort to do it biologically. And I think they're leading up to a third movie with another character that was a super soldier.
Well, there are definitely, even the term super soldier kind of gives away who you're talking about, but
exactly.
there are references to not him per se, but how he came to be in the Hulk without giving anything away.
That's right.
It definitely seems like we're setting the stage for a movie about that that particular character.
Captain America is who we're talking about, of course.
Yeah. Let's
I'm looking forward to a great period World War II era Captain America picture, and I think that it would fit in nicely with Iron Man and now the Hulk. And, you have at the end of that picture, the post-credit sequence being him waking up in modern times, And
right. And so he can then go on and fight crime in modern times. Well, I think that's very likely. I don't follow the rumor mill as to whether that's planned, but it seems almost certain based on having watched that movie that we're going to see a Captain America movie. I can't imagine that we're not. So we got that to look forward to. Plus, it looks like more from Iron Man and more from the Hulk too, coming down the pipe.
Oh yeah, they've set it up. It's going to be a lot of fun, and this movie was great. I so much more fun than that movie a few years ago.
Yeah, more fun than the Ang Lee movie. We were just talking about that before the show started. I really liked the Ang Lee movie. I thought it like as just kind of a very weird science fiction story, sort of a remake of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I thought it was cool. but it wasn't much fun. It was pretty heavy, and I think the Incredible Hulk.
More of an arts film than a superhero film, almost. You know,
yeah.
it's like a
exactly, yeah,
yeah.
So I feel like they've gone in the right direction. This felt more like something Jack Kirby would approve of, and it felt more like that TV show I used to watch too. It owed a lot to that. So,
oh yeah,
it was good. Well, I guess we ought to start the program here. Here on Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network, we're going to be talking about questions about the future, and we're going to be providing answers to questions about the future. So if you have a question about the future that you've always wanted to ask or that you think would contribute to the discussion, please join our chat on the chat room or give us a call at 347-215-8972. So I deliberately left this wide open. We can ask and answer any questions that we like about the future, and I think I'll start with one, unless, Michael, we already have anything in the chat room?
No, we were speculating on other superheroes we should reborn.
The Phantom was mentioned.
Yeah, but only if we do a good Phantom.
Yeah, we had a bad Phantom a few years ago, didn't we?
Yeah, we had a bad Daredevil. I mean...
Exactly.
Well, they could redo The Shadow. That was pretty good. But,
yeah.
Someone suggested you flash forward to Another Phantom. Yeah, The Shadow of Sir Malachi, and I said that at the same time. Look at that. Hey, it's fun to read the chat room.
Are you Sir Malachi?
Don't we have a reader named Sir Malachi here in the... Am I reading his name wrong?
Yeah, that's correct.
Malachi,
I'm just wondering if you're Sir Malachi, that's your alter ego, and you're posting to yourself.
No.
He's my sock puppet. No. He is an individual with whom I have never worked before. It's just
checking.
Using synchronicity. Okay, so I'm going to start with a question about the future. I'm going to throw one out here, and let's see what we can come up with. Also, this is from Michigan. So there. Okay, I got to stop reading the chat. I'll go crazy if I keep doing.
Should we do answers in advance and see if we can be, funny or correct?
We're not going to do Jeopardy here, okay? No answers.
Yeah,
I was thinking like the Great Karnak. If you come up with an answer and then there comes a question, it could be.
That'd
fun.
Be great. I touch the envelope to my head, and Stephen will repeat what I
Jody
said, and I'll
Foster.
Get an annoyed look. Yeah, exactly. Okay, here's my first question about the future. This will get the discussion going, and I look forward to comments from the chat room as well, and anyone who wants to call. Question one: can we predict the future?
Well, that's interesting.
Yes.
Yes and no.
Okay.
But
okay.
Not very far into the future with much accuracy.
I think that's a good way of putting it. What was the quote I've quoted from Yoda from Empire Strikes Back a few posts
always
ago?
Always in motion, the future is, right.
That's right, always in motion. So even if Yoda can't do it, we sure can't do it. But, I mean, there are some things that we can say, but, there's a lot of variables flying out there, and so it's hard to say with any kind of level of certainty what the future will hold. But
well, it seems to me, if I can take a stab at my own question, that it kind of depends. I guess is the answer that it initially comes to mind to me when I ask this question, because there are pieces of the future that seem fairly predictable, and that we can make predictions about even into the distant. Remember, we talked about the distant future a few weeks back. And we were talking about the heat death of the future, and that, barring some really weird intervention like on our part that technology might allow, the heat death of the universe is a fairly likely outcome, even though it comes way, way, way down the line. So some things we can actually predict very far out, and then some things we can't even predict. We don't know what's going to come up in the chat room 30 seconds from now, right? What I'm going to say 30 seconds from now. The future is highly variable in some areas and highly predictable in just a few areas. And so I think there's a lot of confusion about what's predictable and what isn't. And people who make it more confusing are people like Ray Kurzweil, who seem to predict specifics quite accurately, quite frequently. And it makes you wonder, is there more to it, or... is there something to this whole idea of he's tapped into this law of accelerating returns? and he's actually able to, you know, with a certain level of specificity, say this particular development by this year. I guess the question might be rephrased as, do we buy the whole Kurzweil thing? Is he actually predicting the future?
Well, I mean, and he is, and he's been remarkably successful in it. I think because he has limited his predictions to things that are fairly predictable.
Right.
And
okay.
And that would be basically it's Moore's law. Basically, he's making extrapolations based on Moore's law, and so that's. And it's more than that. I want to give the man his due. He, you know, what he has accomplished in his books has been remarkable. But he is wise enough not to make the sort of predictions that would are just not possible. You know, he's basically
silver unitards and flying cars.
Yeah, exactly. At what point would that become the style? You know, so yeah, he's wise not to make predictions like that. This actually it brings me to the book I wanted to bring up tonight, Phil. What you asked your question. The book is Physics of the Impossible. It's by Macio Kaku, I believe, and he had quoted in the book this line: "Anything that is not forbidden is mandatory." And what he means by that is that if the laws of physics don't forbid it in the long run, he predicts it'll be done. You know, provided we don't wipe ourselves out or something.
Right. Okay.
And
so, in predicting technological outcomes, Kurzweil is, you know, if you follow Keiku's view of the future, he's just falling in line with it, right? If you any
right.
By that way of thinking, any technological prediction that you make will come true eventually. Is that fair to say?
That's right. And so, you know, if things that seem like really out there for us, you know, like conquering aging, for example. I mean, obviously we're on board with that, Phil. But I mean, the population as a whole would find that bizarre. The thing is, there's nothing in physics or science in general that would say that it would be impossible to do, and therefore, according to that, you know, to that logic, it's mandatory. It will happen. It's a question of when, and so I like that way of looking at it, and it sort of creates the idea that, you know, if it's not so much you know, what can we do? It's a question of what can't we do, and it turns out that the things that we can't do,
mm-hmm.
with sufficient enough technology, the list is pretty short of things that just strictly impossible. What's that?
Things that we absolutely can never do. Can you give an example? Or
well, he enlists in this book. It's a very cool book. I recommend it to our listeners very highly. He puts in three different classes of impossibilities. Okay, class one impossibilities are things that are impossible with our technology now, but are look like they will be impossible in the near term future. And that's class one impossibilities. Class two impossibilities are things that are impossible now and probably will be throughout our lifetimes and into the distant future. But there's nothing in physics that says that you couldn't do it, provided that, you know, you might have a galactic level civilization that might be able to pull it off. Okay, that's a class two impossibility. A class three impossibility are things that we really believe are literally impossible and that can never be done. And he put in class three impossibilities perpetual motion machines and precognition.
Oh, okay.
So
interesting. So one of the things ostensibly or arguably that he put into completely impossible is like predicting the future.
Exactly. And to the extent that we're talking Yoda time here, you know.
Right.
We're Kurzweil doesn't hold himself out as Yoda, and neither do we, obviously. So when we're talking about the future, I think that as long as we're talking generally and we base it on extrapolations of what we see now, I think there's a chance that we might actually get things right. And so that's what we try to do.
All right. So can we predict the future? I think we got a resounding it depends on that one.
Yeah. Exactly.
All right. Well, I expected as much. Okay, so next question.
You predicted as much, huh?
Yeah. No, always in motion the future is. I never know what's going to happen on this show. Who's next? Who's got a question?
I'll toss one out. I did. I came up with three. I did them in reverse order of their specific speculistishness, if I can create a word. And that's this. Life expectancy. Can we, independent of whether it's Aubrey Gray or Kurzweil or anybody else looking at longevity and treating senescence as an illness and beating it, can we look at anything else and say, yeah, life expectancy is going to increase dramatically? And I'd argue that, yes, we can.
Okay.
So the question is, putting those guys aside, are there other reasons to think it's going to happen? Is that I'm not sure I understand what
yes,
the question
because,
is.
Yes, because we can't, we don't yet have the data to definitively answer that they're correct.
Yeah.
We don't have the science yet, and we don't have the biology yet, in the case of Aubrey de Grey, to say, hey, we beat it. We won't know until we do.
So lacking the science.
But I'd argue there's another way to do it.
Okay, well, okay. Let's hear that.
Yeah, I'm game. Go. I got nothing.
Okay, this is big picture, Neanderthal era through to Roman times, Roman peak of Roman civilization, 2,000 years ago, more or less. Life expectancy of humans, approximately 20 years. Upper Paleolithic period, for a short period there was a spike up where life expectancy was closer to 30, but by and large, that whole time, 20 plus. Then you start to come forward and you're in the 20s and the 30s, low 30s. Like, you know, you spike up in North America, pre-Columbus times, low 30s, all the way up until the early 20th century.
Yeah.
And from the early 20th century, 1902, to now current world average, not first world industrial average, but the current world average, a little over 78.5. And you go, wow, in one century, we doubled it.
Huh.
So, you know,
what are you saying then?
Thousands of generations, no change. Four generations, huge change.
Yeah.
So if you follow the trend, right?
Not that it's mathematical, but I'd argue that the technological advances that we were capable of in the early 20th century, which was largely soap and antibiotics, not that I'm scoffing at either, but they seem pretty simplistic to us now.
Right.
Double life expectancy. Technological advances I'm expecting in the early part of this century is going to more than double it again.
Okay. Well, you know what? I'll buy that. And come to think of it, Stephen, since you're standing in place of our virtual guest, Dr. Michio Kaku, what would his take on this be?
On life expectancy? Let's see. Where would he put life? Let's see here. He's got life extension. Well, he doesn't have it listed. I'm sorry to say he does not list it in the contents of his book, but I'm going to put it as a class one impossibility.
Okay.
And by that I mean it's something that's currently impossible in life extension, but that's something that we will probably see within our lifetimes.
Okay, so per Michael's framing of the question, even though we can't count on, say, Aubrey de Grey's or Ray Kurzweil's or anyone else's assessment of how it will occur, based on the fact that it is something that's technically feasible within the Kaku paradigm, this is something that we should expect to see happen.
Yes,
yeah,
and I think that, and where I almost started here, since the assignment was the three questions, I almost started with the question was, what will that number be? What will it be whenever we get to the point where we can do it, whatever the changes are going to be in the early part of this century that are going to give us this big boost in the numbers, what's that number going to look like? And there I was stumped. I have no idea.
Well, because you see incremental things. I mean, I think I just read last week that the average life expectancy in the U.S. just notched up. They just estimated that up. So, you see these little incremental jumps. But not the big jump, which is what you're talking about, right? You're talking about like a major leap hitting a new plateau kind of a
deal. Yeah, I'm talking about like 150 is you know, rewrites all the actuarial tables, and 300 to 500 is not out of reach.
Hmm.
And you know, I mean, we're talking about, you know, 50 being the new 30 kind of thing. Yeah, where you know,
I'm talking about 50 being the new 15 kind of thing.
Well, when I'm 150, Michael, you'll be a little older, Stephen a little younger. We can get together and we'll talk about what we think the new plateau is. It seems like we're having this conversation
prematurely.
Yeah, 150 is the new 100. You know.
Yeah, it'll probably go something like that. All right. Well, this is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're asking and answering random questions about the future. If you have a question about the future, join us on our live online chat or give us a call at 347-215-8972. Okay, Stephen, did you have a question about the future that you wanted to throw out?
Yeah, sure. Invisibility. Will that be possible?
Wow.
I'm talking about invisibility, like on the battlefield, or I don't know. Name the situation where you would like to be invisible. Will that be technically feasible?
Well, I'm going to take a stab at this one. That the big it depends is going to apply here as well, and this time it's going to depend on what you mean by invisibility. I think that.
Invisible to, I'm talking about visible light. Okay.
Yeah, you know, I don't know if we're ever going to have the Claude Rains thing, okay? I don't know if we're going to have, like, the invisible man kind of invisibility. But certainly, as far as, like, stealth technology getting closer and closer to the ability to just completely mask the presence of an object, to provide a complete illusion of non-presence of an object and just show a field of vision that you would see absent that object being there, I think that the technology will definitely take us there. And I think that per the book, that would be a probably level one or at worst level two type impossibility. I think probably a level one type impossibility. That's something that's feasible within the laws of physics, and therefore something that that we can expect to see happen, or that we can reasonably predict will happen, whether we actually live to see it or not. It seems that the technology is moving closer and closer in that direction all the time. Certainly, if you bring something like nanotechnology into the mix, your ability to provide that kind of illusion of not being there is greatly magnified. Although your detection ability probably goes up quite a bit too. So there might be something of an arms race that develops between enhanced ways of seeing and enhanced ways of hiding. And it could be that they'll provide what would be complete invisibility to the naked eye, but those objects will still be perfectly detectable by other means, I would think.
Well, the chapter on invisibility in this book I thought was fascinating. He does list it as a class one impossibility, meaning he thinks that there'll probably be military applications for this within the century, he believes. And he talks a lot about the metamaterials now that are coming out that they've already shown that can make something invisible to the microwave spectrum and now to red light. And he says at the rate that these things are going, that it'll likely the metamaterials will be the way that this is done. But he also mentions, you know, real simple things like, you know, getting a camera on one side of your body and a screen on the other side of your body, and it looks like you can look right through somebody, and it provides pretty good invisibility from one angle.
Right.
If you step in one direction slightly, even if you can't see the person behind the screen, you can begin to pick out that it's a screen just by moving slightly. Okay. And he says that with hologram technologies, perhaps even that could work. But I think it's basically his prediction that it'll be metamaterials that'll be the way that invisibility is brought onto the battlefield. And it probably won't be perfect invisibility, but it doesn't have to be. It can be just really, really good camouflage, basically, is what it amounts to.
Or even really good but temporary.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the thing. Even the earliest implementations of camouflage, when it works, it gives you enough invisibility to fool the person who's looking at you at the moment, and that's ultimately all that the invisibility, I mean, that's what matters with invisibility, right? It doesn't matter if somebody who happened to be looking from another angle could see you if no one is looking from that angle, right? As long as as long as the technology you're implementing is fooling the person you're trying to fool, you're invisible. So
that's right.
I think you get effective levels of it.
Exactly.
In a military context, too, I think that there'll be less pressure to have invisibility because you'll have for all practical purposes, invisibility. For example, right now I'm invisible to everybody in the chat, and I'm invisible to you guys because I can do what I'm doing. Nobody needs to see me. And when you can manipulate the battlefield environment without having to put yourself physically in the space, or you can manipulate the inside of the weapons lab in Dr. Evil's lair without actually being there, invisibility becomes, you know, sort of moot, but in a sense you have it. You're manipulating the environment, but nobody can see you.
That's a brilliant point. Absolutely, yeah. What have you got when you're talking about these robots on the battlefield are unmanned aerial vehicles? You know, that's invisibility. Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
For the actual warrior, for the actual combatant, you've achieved complete invisibility. The best way to do it, which is by not being there at all. Right. I mean,
that's right.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
Okay, so I think on the invisibility question, we're going to say it's not so much an it depends. That's a yes.
Yeah.
We will have invisibility. Okay, next question. I'm going to throw one out here. This one's a little more philosophical, goes to some of the discussions, particularly in the comments, but also in some of the blog posts we've had over the last few weeks. Is there an advantage to having a bleak outlook on the future?
Wow, okay. For me personally, no. But I think that there is a place for people that have a bleak outlook on the future.
What do you mean a place?
Okay. I think there's an important function for people like Bill Joy. Okay, the future doesn't need us guy. Okay. I would hate to live like that. I would hate for that to be my personal philosophy. I think that sort of thing would not be, I would not want to live with that outlook on life. But I think by being out there and saying these negative things that could be, you know, our potential futures for us, it helps those who are, you know, more positive thinking to say, no, it doesn't have to be that way, and to meet him and to argue the point, and to perhaps even avoid the future that he's warning of. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So the advantage is that maybe it's not advantageous for everybody to have that outlook, but it's advantageous that there's somebody who has it, because that gives us something it gives us a picture of what we want to avoid. Is that the idea?
Yeah, that's the idea. What's your thought on that?
Well, I think that historically, yes, there has been a tremendous advantage to having a variably bleak or optimistic outlook on the future, depending on your circumstances. But a bleak outlook on the future provides exactly the protection, Stephen, that you were talking about. If your life is mostly a question of warding off potential threats, then having a very bleak view as to how happy of a day you're going to have tomorrow is actually quite helpful to you, because you're going to be thinking about each one of those threats that you're going to be facing and how you're going to fight those off. And in fact, you know, going back to the whole human imperative and the Speculus Manifesto, the idea that we have arrived to where we are as a species today by being able to kind of look ahead a little bit and to try to improve our situation, a good deal of that has had to do with protecting ourselves from disastrous outcomes. And I've thought about this a lot, because we were writing about the fact that, not to repeat the whole story, but basically we can provide another link on the blog, but basically the very interesting case of two guys predicting the future, one who says the world's going to be a horrible mess, the other guy who says actually the world's getting better all the time, The guy who says it's going to be a horrible mess gets it wrong every single time. The guy who says it's getting better all the time makes good, accurate predictions and has tons of data backing him up. And everyone seems to laud and esteem the guy who gets it wrong.
Right.
And no one has much use for the guy who gets it right. And I think that they're you know, if nothing else, it sounds like if you want to sell books, there's a huge advantage to having a bleak outlook on the future, right?
Yeah. Talking,
you know, purely tactical terms there, because it's the message that people are inclined to hear. It's the message that we are prepared to hear in terms of protecting ourselves against the possibility of a bad future. And it's why I think an idea like, this kind of excessive and extreme sort of variations on climate change that we saw in the comments, or not in the comments, but actually that you had quoted in the other blog post that you did this week. It's where those kinds of ideas come from. It's the old, if it bleeds, it leads. There is a great, I think, mimetic bonus to a message that has a fear component attached to it. And we value a warning above a promise of good stuff simply because that has enabled us to survive up to this point. So I think traditionally there has been a big advantage to having a bleak outlook on the future. And I think one of the interesting things about the world that we live in today is it's actually time to start turning that boat just a little bit and getting people to start taking a somewhat more balanced view.
You know, and I don't see it really going that direction, Phil, because instead of people taking the opportunity, saying, "Okay, we have this within our grasp, let's go get it," instead of taking that, it seems like it's hard to get away from human nature. I guess what we do is we define disaster down. So in order to have a disaster now, it has to be, our level. It doesn't have to be as great of a disaster anymore for it to be an absolute disaster by comparison to just a generation ago. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we talked about this in terms of what the American public is willing to accept in terms of casualties from a war, right? We talked about this about the Civil War. I mean, and again, not to take the case that I'm for any particular level of casualties. I don't want anybody dying on the battlefield, but we live in an era now where if 4,000 people have died, 4,000 Americans have died in Iraq, that's viewed by a lot of folks as just absolutely unacceptable, catastrophic. And we had the interesting example of a single Civil War battle where you'd have that many people die in a day, or considerably more people than that die in a day. World War II battles where that many people would die in a day. So there definitely is less tolerance for bad stuff. And the lower your tolerance for bad stuff gets, I guess the easier it is to achieve the level of catastrophe, right?
Yeah. Or you just, as a society, you get good at avoiding catastrophes. And instead of celebrating that, we just... We continue to have the same number of catastrophes. It's just that our catastrophes are, why in my day we had real catastrophes. Our catastrophes just are pretty pitiful compared to other catastrophes that from a generation.
Yeah, well, we'd have a flu outbreak and it would kill millions of people and stuff. Right?
That's right. In my day, so.
I really think there is something to that. I think that it's mimetic and genetic baggage that we have to take a rather pessimistic look at the future. I think that's a built-in defense mechanism. But it's like some of these other built-in defense mechanisms. When last time PJ Manny was on, we were talking about the fear of the other, right? There was a time maybe when it was Homo sapiens versus Neanderthals, perhaps, or maybe even farther back then than that, when it was mammals versus reptiles, that this, deep fear of the other was something that provided a biological and evolutionary advantage, and it was something that we needed to have. But now we all look at that and we say, no, that is something that actually hurts us. It doesn't allow us to become the kind of civilization that we could be because we carry that leftover bit of evolutionary baggage around with us. And I think this kind of fear of the future is a similar piece of baggage, and it's one that sooner or later, and I hope sooner, we're going to start identifying it as such and seeing it as as something that is maybe holding us back.
Yeah.
So
that's great question, Phil.
Asked and answered, Your Honor.
I think it's Michael's turn.
You don't want to go throwing these out there unless you have some thoughts on what the answer might be, I guess.
Absolutely.
Is the way this works. Well, this is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We are asking and in some cases answering our own questions about the future. We'd like to get your questions or your answers or thoughts on the future. If you have those, please join us in our live chat or give us a call at 347-215-8972. Okay, who's got another question about the future?
I'll give you a question, and
okay.
I'll set it up very little. Are we at the point classically defined, or at least traditionally defined in the modern era, as the point of peak oil production?
Ooh, good question.
Wow. That's kind of a question about the present.
Well, here's the definition. It's the point in time when the rate of global production, and now I'm talking getting oil out of the ground, is reached. After that point, so the question could be, when will we get to the point after that point, and what will that look like? But after that point, the production begins to decline.
All right, Stephen, you got thoughts on that one?
Yeah. What would it look like? Well, here's the deal. The reason it looked real bad, real fast, and here's why: gas prices would skyrocket because there'd not be enough gas to go around. Okay, and plus you've got the economies in India and in China coming online, and they want their first cars, and you know. And we've had generations of people in cars over here, so we're not giving up our cars either. And so you got more and more people demanding less and less gasoline, and so you got both supply side and production side. You have both demand and supply problems, and so you very quickly see gasoline just shooting through the roof. That's what it looks like. Now, why do I think that we have not reached it? Because we've got a lot of places left in this country left to drill. And politically, it will become, it's very odd to me right now at the moment that politically that there's any argument at this point that we need to drill domestically. I don't see that as a Republican or Democrat issue. I think that I just don't understand the thinking, and it seems like both Republicans and Democrats have got it wrong. We do have to drill, and we've got to get our production up. That seems logical. But
how could they both be wrong? One of them's always correct, aren't they?
I think we've got bilateral wrongness here.
I would make an argument that it's
bipartisan wrongness.
I would make an argument that it's possible that the national security, the best national security argument you could make against drilling goes like this. We're not going to drill ANWR, we're not going to drill the coastal shelf until we figure out how to run the DOD without oil. If we can't run the Defense Department without oil, then let's leave that stuff in the ground until you know, that we're saving that for the rainy day.
Yeah,
Because we could drill ANWR tomorrow, it's not going to change the price of gas at the pump more than a nickel or a dime, tops.
Yeah.
I think that's a really good point. And you know, to go back to the original question, have we reached peak oil? You know, why I would say we have not is because if we were really there, if we were really at the peak or somewhere sliding down the other side now, we'd be digging up the shale and making oil. We'd be drilling ANWR. We'd be, you know,
yeah.
I think those
because we'd be paying $15 a gallon at the pump.
Right. I think the political barriers would probably evaporate in light of people's desperation to keep their cars going, to keep the economy going, et cetera.
It turns out that the math of the production argument assumes, as economists always do, that all else is equal. Well,
yeah.
You know, $150 barrel oil is not equal to the $20 barrel of oil we were producing just a few years ago. Those aren't the same...
Sure.
That's not the same barrel of oil. It's the same amount of energy, more or less, but it's not the same environment where you go, yeah, at $200 barrel of oil, I think I am producing shale. I think I am drilling in places I wouldn't now drill. I mean, there are known reserves in places that are just too darn expensive to go get, even at $125, $135, $140 a barrel.
Algae starts to look real good, and all, I mean, nuclear and electric cars and all, you know, all the alternatives begin to look good when you get over a certain point. And I believe that we have reached that point, and that point is going to be more important even than peak oil. The point at which the alternatives become viable, and we have passed that. And in a way, it's good. Here's the good news in this. The good news is that we didn't have to reach peak oil before the alternatives became viable. And now we're going to develop the alternatives, and that'll save us when we really do hit peak oil.
Maybe. Or perhaps we actually have reached peak oil, and now that's pushing us to develop these alternatives. You know, the argument from economics, I mean, that's hard math for me. I couldn't say. It seems to me that if it were really peak, or we were really on that rapid downward slide, we're not very far into it yet, because I would expect things to look a lot more scary and desperate than they do right now. Right now, it just feels more annoying, right, than anything else. I mean, it's worrying and it's annoying, but the big peak oil scenarios always give you this very bleak, you know, rioting in the streets kind of picture, and we're certainly not to that yet. But you know, maybe
I tell you the mark of the apocalypse will be Phil and I on mopeds.
Hey, I have a bike. I ride a regular bike a lot, so.
If you had told the candle-buying world in the middle part of the 19th century that whale oil was about to go away, and that, you know, you're going to go back to lighting things with whatever you made candles with before whale oil took over, and it's going to be sitting around the campfire again, people would have been pretty alarmed by that bleak outlook. It turns out that, yeah, whale oil was going to go away. We over-harvested the whale oil, and it was kind of an inefficient way to light the world anyway.
Right.
But, you know, oil. And then we started lighting it with oil, and right after that, electricity. And so I think that the two go together. Yes, is there whale oil still in the world today? Yes. Does anybody use it to light their house? No. Is there going to be petroleum either in the ground or in a refinery or available in the world sometime in the future post-peak oil? Yes. Are people going to be using it to move cars around? No. We're going to be doing something else.
Yeah,
we'll do something else. Well, as John Smart explains it, we didn't abandon the Stone Age because we ran out of rocks.
That's right.
And that's what's going to happen as we move on to other ways of powering our vehicles and our economy.
Absolutely.
So I don't know if we answered the question. I guess we did. It depends. We may or may not.
Oh,
hard
man.
To say. Always in motion.
Well, I think we're there. I think 5 years from now, as soon as, say, 12 to 20 quarters from now, we're going to be able to look at the chart and go, yeah, we were there in 2007, 2008, maybe 2009, and we just didn't know it yet.
Yeah, it could be like a recession. You need a certain amount of runway into it before you really know for sure that that's where you are. Yeah. Very interesting. Okay, on to our next question about the future. I think we got time for one or maybe two more. Michael, were there any in the chat room? Any questions coming up or comments or thoughts?
No, good reactions to the discussion, but that's where we're at. We haven't added anything else.
Well, Phil, we don't have a whole lot of time left, but so I want to just go over the impossibilities and where they fall according to this author and in the book Physics of the Impossible.
Oh, okay, that's great. Let me throw one last question at you, though, and you can work this in, okay? Because
okay.
My final question was, when will we be able to, and I got this one also watching Iron Man, when will we be able to fly?
Personal flight.
Personal flight, yes.
Okay, according
to... Let me take a whack at the answer, and then we're going to go back to Stephen's definitions of impossibility here.
Okay.
But I'll take a whack, and this is my third question, too. And it, unfortunately, I didn't frame it as a question, so I'm just going to use it as an answer to that question. Singularity-like things that Kurzweil describes are going to happen. The steps toward it are going to happen incrementally, and the increments will eventually start to get really small. And by increments, I mean increments of time, where it might take 5 years to do something now. By the time we get to the end of that 5 years, doing something equally technologically challenging might take 5 months. And at the end of that 5 months, it's going to take 5 minutes. And as the increments get small enough, that you can see the impact in your life and go, yeah, you know what, I'm not buying a gasoline-burning car because it's going to last 5 years, and in 2 years we're going to have something else. As those increments start to get small, everybody's going to see it, and there'll be no debate anymore about the, quote, singularity. It'll just, it'll be happening, and you'll all be able to see, we'll all be able to see it. So there, levels of impossibility.
Okay.
Okay, go.
All right, let me take a crack at your question, Phil. The author here would put it as a class one impossibility, something that's impossible currently but would be possible in the near future. And he says that a prerequisite technology to personal flight is room temperature superconductors.
Okay.
I'm not sure exactly why. He says basically that, you know, the type of thing that Marty McFly's floating hoverboard and things like that would be possible with this, with room temperature superconductors, and it has something to do with maglev and things like that. But
right, well, Tony Stark had that arc drive powering his rocket boots, right? So it's similar. You know, you need some big leap.
Yeah, and like. Exactly, and so yeah, we're talking a big leap. But there's it might be something we haven't even thought of that would give us the personal flight. So yeah. I guess it depends on your definition of personal flight. Yeah, there are rocket packs now that you could strap on but stay aloft for 30 seconds. And then there, of course, there's the powered parachutes that you could pull out of the back of your trunk of your car, strap to your back, and take off and fly for a couple of hours, but at 20 miles an hour. It just depends on what you have in mind. But if, you know, if we're talking like floating, like almost at will, you're talking about something exotic, and that might be kind of what
class
he's talking
two,
about.
Class two, maybe?
Yeah.
20 years.
20 years, okay.
18 years to work out the basic technology, and then 2 years of rapidly increasing, exponentially increasing advancement, and in 20 years we're there.
Michael calls it then a class one impossibility. Okay, I'm sorry, Phil.
I was just I'll take the 20 years because then I, you know, by the time I'm 65, I can fly. I like that answer. So
that's cool.
There you go.
I'll go with that too. Hey, we're optimistic around here.
Yeah,
okay,
that
here's the,
works for me.
Yeah, class one impossibilities: force fields, invisibility, phasers, and Death Stars, teleportation, telepathy, psychokinesis, robots. And by that he means artificial general intelligence. Extraterrestrials and UFOs, starships, antimatter and anti-universes. Okay, class two impossibilities, faster than light travel, time travel, parallel universes. Again, these are things that are impossible to us now and to us in the foreseeable future, but are not, the physics say that it might happen, but it would take a civilization millions of years more advanced than ours.
Sufficiently advanced as to be indistinguishable from magic descendants might have access to these.
Exactly.
And when he says parallel universes, he means like access to them, right?
Yes.
He's not talking about creating them. He's just talking about having some kind of like being able to view them or go to them or something. Is that right?
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
And we probably, you know, there might be that we already theoretically know about parallel universes. So, I mean, obviously he's talking about access to them. Now,
okay.
Class three impossibilities, perpetual motion machines and precognition. And that's it.
Okay.
And so, anyway, interesting book. I'm enjoying reading it. So I recommend it highly. Physics of the Impossible.
Great stuff. Well, listen. This has been a really fun program tonight. I think we're going to have to make a point of maybe every couple months or so, let's do one of these kind of grab bag, just throw topics out and talk about stuff because, it's kind of fun to do that. And I feel like it makes for kind of a lively conversation. Enjoyed it very much. What do we got going on in terms of music this evening?
Okay, the band's name is Chewy Marble.
Right on.
I have no idea about that name, but that's the name of the band, Chewy Marble, and the song is Black and White.
All right, so Black and White by Chewy Marble. Stephen, thank you very much. Michael, thanks to you and to all our friends in the chat room and for all of those who are listening. We will look forward to being with you all again on the next Fast Forward Radio. Good night.
And check out our show notes over at The Speculist.
Thank you. Yeah. Don't forget the show notes.
Okay. All right.
Good night.
Forgive me all my sorrows.